Geekscape.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today's narration is the seventh one from Front Camphor by Ed Volsink. An SS Untersturmführer had welcomed Ed and his group ashore at the landing place, but now showed far more interest in examining the captured amphibious craft. Eventually, he overcame his curiosity and gave orders to supply Ed's group with whatever supplies or food they required. He then led Ed to a motorcycle combination and drove him to the SS regimental headquarters. On arrival, Ed was met by an elderly Sturmbannführer who saluted first and then examined Ed's identity papers. Upon finding that Ed was not only a member of the NSDAP, but also held officer's rank in the Allgemeine SS, the older man's friendliness changed to real comradeship. He immediately offered Ed the use of his personal billet until such time as his new orders came through. The Sturmbannführer's quarters were rather comfortable, located in a nearby damaged house which had been fortified as a command post. Ed accepted the offer and proceeded to contact his unit by field telephone to check up on their welfare. All was in order, as the group were resting up as guests of the SS unit, supplied with decent living quarters and plenty of food. Ed treated himself to his first wash in 10 days, and rested up in a real bed, luxuries unheard of in the field. The Sturmbannführer's personal attendant took away Ed's filthy uniform and underwear for cleaning. The attendant was an SS Hilfährin, a female SS auxiliary, not unusual at this stage of the war, when every able man was needed elsewhere. By the late stages of the war, most of the non-combatant duties were assigned to older men, the war invalids who could still serve but were not frontline fit, and those not physically fit enough for regular military service. Initially, these personnel manned the telephone and mail service, as well as performing home front security and police duties. In the closing stages of the war, these men were replaced by women who served in all sections except frontline combat. The next morning, Ed awoke as a new man, refreshed by decent sleep and presented with clean underwear and uniform. This was followed by an impressive breakfast with the SS regimental staff. The fortified villa, where Ed had slept, contained all the parts of the regimental administration, as well as providing lodgings for the staff group. Later, however, when Ed entered the communications center and requested a telephone connection with the Brandenburg Operations and Task Control Center, he got his first impression that something strange was in the air. The communications center had the usual mix of field telephones and shortwave radios, but had additional equipment, 2 long-distance telephones. Sturmbannführer Mischke muttered, "That is my responsibility," and indicated the long-distance apparatus manned by an NCO. Mischke introduced Ed to the NCO and ordered that the free line would be at Ed's disposal. Ed was used to contacting the ZBV-800 at long distance, but on this occasion was astonished at the speed in which the connection was made. The ZBV-800 had no further orders for him on that date because other sections of his Kampfergruppe had yet to return from their missions. The control center ordered Ed to remain at his current location until the whole Kampfergruppe was back in German-held territory. The Sturmbannführer had been standing behind Ed following the conversation. He tapped him on the shoulder and whispered that he would take care of Ed and his group for as long as was required. Ed could hear the NCO talking on the other telephone about routine matters like supplies of bread and vehicle repairs. Although the sector was being shelled continuously, there was little of interest being discussed. Mischke ask Ed about his plans for the day. He replied that he would first like to check up on his men and see to their welfare. The officer immediately put a motorcycle at his disposal, together with an SS Rottenführer, a corporal, as a guide. Before Ed set out to see his men, Mischke asked him to accompany him to his office and indicate where on the map the enemy amphibious craft were located so that he could clearly instruct his artillery to destroy them. The bay area was clearly marked on the map, therefore Ed made no mistakes when he measured out the exact location which had to be shelled. The two amphibious craft that his group had stolen had already been taken away by a specialist Wehrmacht unit early that morning. Ed's attention returned to the communication center, and especially the free telephone. Ed decided to ignore military protocol and asked Mischke directly about the mysterious free line. The officer looked intensely at Ed and then asked if he would like to dine with them alone that evening so that matters could be discussed privately. Before he could reply, Mischke then asked him to have four of his most experienced men available at 8 p.m. Somewhat confused by this evasive reply to his direct question, Ed agreed and Mischke left. Ed went outside to look for the motorcycle and guide he had been promised, only to find that this consisted of an absolutely third-rate motorbike manned by an optimistic corporal with an amputated right arm. Guided by a handmade map and the one-armed corporal's local knowledge, Ed found the sites where his group were camped out. He passed on the report from the ZBV 800 that they had to stay put until they could be reunited with the rest of the family. He remained with his men to share a meal and selected four Unteroffiziers with full combat equipment to meet him at the SS regimental headquarters at 8 p.m. On the journey back to the Villa HQ, Ed could hear the rumble and explosions of the heavy artillery shelling the River Bay area. The enemy artillery lost no time in replying to the bombardment, and several times Ed and his guide had to abandon the motorcycle and shelter behind groups of rocks. At 7 p.m, Ed had his private dinner meeting with the Sturmbannführer Mischke. The meal was nothing fancy but tasty, washed down with local red wine. After some delay, the officer finally got down to his story. When the SS regiment first took over the sector from a Wehrmacht unit, Mischke had inherited a section of signals personnel who took care of the telephone system and exchange based in the cellars of the post office of the nearby town. The SS officer had checked the signalmen's identities and status, cross-checked their sold books with their parent unit, and everything appeared to be in order. Yet Mischke himself was unhappy with the situation. Certain things did not add up. The signalsmen spoke better German than a real German would, and this bothered him. Without explaining to anyone else, he installed the free line via his divisional headquarters, the regular line via the post office building he used only for minor purposes. Unsure of the situation, and afraid of being made a fool, he had not reported his suspicions. The arrival of Ed and his ZBV unit was like a gift from heaven, because as a secretive semi-independent group, they could penetrate the post office exchange, carry out an inspection, and as strangers, he could remain in the background. Ed agreed to cooperate with the action. He asked how many of the signalsmen were included in Mischke's food distribution list, and was told 12, including one officer. The signals group worked in sections of three, day and night. Their living and sleeping quarters were also in the post office cellars, with washing and latrine facilities on the ground floor. They were armed with standard-issue K-98 Mauser rifles, a few pistols, and some hand grenades. The operation was on for that night. Mischke had already set 20 of his Waffen-SS men hiding out in the direct neighborhood of the target building, but was reluctant to use them in case his suspicions were wrong. Ed had his four NCOs present, all armed with Sten guns and their regular field equipment and weapons. The town was not very large, and so it was difficult to approach the building soundlessly. Therefore, Ed and his men did exactly the opposite, behaving like a noisy bunch of drunkards until they were just outside the entrance, which was not locked. They entered quickly and descended to the cellars, where they found four signalsmen, including the officer, in the telephone exchange. The signalers were taken completely by surprise. Ed sent three of his men into the living quarters to deal with the rest, not difficult for men of their experience. Ed ordered the signalers over against a wall with their hands up. Only the officer resisted. He made a sudden move towards the switchboard table, so Ed shot him in the left knee, which had the desired effect. The wounded man staggered to join his men against the wall. Ed's Feldwebel searched the signalers and collected their pistols and fighting knives. From the next room came the sound of two shots, and then silence. Almost immediately, the telephone panel spluttered into life. The connection lights glowed as Ed ordered the wounded officer to answer the call and pretend that everything was normal. Ed's Feldwebel covered the prisoners, while Ed stood over the signals officer with his fighting knife, promising to cut out his eyes if he attempted to disobey. The wounded man made the connection, lifted the handset, and spoke in English. That was enough proof for Ed. He snatched the telephone from the officer and shouted up the stairs to Mishke. Thinking quickly, he told Mishke to bring his men into the building and to set up a line for Ed direct to the field police. In the midst of these instructions, the phone line started again. This time, Ed answered it. There was a pretty female voice on the line, as Ed made excuses for the absent lieutenant, claiming he had gone urgently to the latrines, and that he would return the call when he came back. This seemed to satisfy the girl on the line, and gave Ed time to act. The SS troops stripped the prisoners and secured their hands with telephone wire, all except the officer. With the help of one of his NCOs, Ed discovered what the officer had been trying to reach for before he was shot. A hidden button marked alarm, plus a lever which could be pulled to shut down the whole telephone system. Feldwebel Kushta ordered the signals officer to return the call and announced that a technical problem meant that the system would have to be shut down for repairs for a few hours. The call was made. Ed threw the shutdown lever and turned to the immediate situation. He told Kushta to run after the SS messenger and tell the field police about the whole situation at the telephone exchange, to send enough men for 12 prisoners, with skilled interrogators to work on the officer. If things could be done quickly, they could continue to contact the enemy, this time with false information. Ed waited for a considerable time before he heard the field police vehicles arrive. First to enter the building was a police captain and two men. Acting in the correct military manner, he reported to the highest-ranking officer present, in this case, Mishke. But the SS officer pointed across to Ed and said, "This is the captain in command." So Ed received the regulation report. Police captain present with 20 men and three of their own signalers. In addition, there was a young intelligence officer who understood the situation in a moment. Ed showed the field police around the cellars, pointing out the equipment and the lever to reconnect the system. The police captain used his own field radio to summon a communications specialist to prepare the system for the wounded lieutenant's involuntary help. Meanwhile, an SS doctor took care of the wounded lieutenant's knee, which was not badly damaged. As far as Ed's part in the action was concerned, it was over. He apologized to Mishke for taking over the operation completely without consulting him, but the SS officer was only too pleased with the results. His suspicions were proved correct, and he appreciated that Ed was used to operating as he did. As the group sauntered back to the SS Regimental HQ, Mishke promised to send coffee and bread to Ed's men by way of thanks. Ett and his group remained in the area for several more days on what felt like holiday leave. He heard from the field police that a stream of false information had been fed to the enemy and that further investigations had exposed treason at higher levels. It appeared that the signals group had been set up by traitors in army liaison circles. A lot of arrests were made further behind the lines as a result of the leak being discovered. Ett's stay with Sturmbannführer Mischke was then terminated as orders reached him that the other sections of the Kampfergruppe had returned and urgent orders were waiting. After the collapse of the so-called July Plot, or the Stauffenberg Conspiracy, the Brandenburg formations were subjected to a series of reorganizations which effectively stripped the division of its specialist troops and reduced the remaining regiments and battalions to ordinary infantry combat status. The Special Infiltration Units and Kampfergruppen were detached from Brandenburg Command, and entire companies of non-German troops were detached and sent for redeployment with the Waffen-SS. Amongst those Brandenburgers sent for redeployment was Ett Volsink, who together with his Kampfergruppe was sent to join the SS Commando School at Friedenthal near Oranienburg on the outskirts of Berlin. Ett's situation was better than most due to heavy losses. Amongst experienced field officers, there were many opportunities for promotion open to young officers with combat experience. At the age of 20, Ett was promoted to the almost unthinkable rank of Hauptsturmführer, captain, and would hold that rank in both the Waffen-SS and the Allgemeine SS. He also remained in contact with his mentors in the SS Hauptamt and continued to be supervised by the RSHA. He was delighted to be serving in the Waffen-SS. He owed his new status and rank to his battle experience in the Brandenburg and the influence of his mentors in the RSHA. Ett had no doubt that the Third Reich would win the war, and like many other young officers, believed that a new generation of secret weapons would help to turn the tide of the war in Germany's favour. He seldom saw his Dutch SS unit, and was continuously on the move across the battlefronts of Europe. The operations he engaged in as a member of SS Oranienburg were no different to those he carried out in the Brandenburg, except that for operational purposes, the command center for Ett's unit was Munich. As full members of the Waffen-SS, Ett and his comrades now wore the SS runes on the collars of their tunics and had their blood group tattooed on the inside of their upper left arm in the SS fashion. Within the first few weeks of relocation to the SS Oranienburg, there was a crisis demanding the intervention of specialist Waffen-SS units. In August 1944, the communist partisans of the Slovak region of Czechoslovakia rose against the Axis powers in anticipation of the Soviet forces advancing through the Carpathian Mountains. Ett and his new unit were immediately sent into the area to provide support operations for the Waffen-SS divisions fighting in the area. Ett's Kampfergruppe were to provide aggressive reconnaissance actions inside partisan-controlled areas. To make matters worse, the Red Army had parachuted reinforcements into Slovakia to support the partisan units. The fighting lasted until late October, and Ett saw many fierce actions against both partisans and regular Red Army units before being rapidly switched to another area of operations when the German forces were gaining the upper hand and commando operations were no longer needed. In the late autumn of 1944, Ett's Kampfergruppe was engaged in an infiltration mission on the Western Front. The targets were the tactical command centres and supply depots, which normally would have been bombed by the Luftwaffe, but due to the lack of operational aircraft, the Kampfergruppe were sent in to destroy the targets with explosives. As the distance from the German front lines was not great, the Kampfergruppe were not disguised in Allied uniforms, but were wearing camouflage outfits. This form of dress had the advantage in that they would be treated as prisoners of war if captured, and not shot on the spot as spies. Moreover, if they were taken prisoner, then there was always the opportunity to escape and rejoin their units, not a possibility if shot as a spy. The sector into which the Kampfergruppe was infiltrating was covered by American forces, and the target installations were also manned by Americans. The Kampfergruppe regarded this last piece of information as extremely useful to the success of the operation. It was generally accepted among the ZBV 800 and the Oranienburg units that the Americans and the Soviets were careless in their guard systems, while the British and the Canadians were much stricter, and therefore more dangerous. It was relatively easy to cross over the front lines, and the Kampfergruppe had already stolen the necessary transport, something that they were experts in doing. On reaching the target area, Ed split the group into two parts. SS Untersturmführer Stowalski, commanding the pioneers with their explosives teams, would go round the compound, laying the charges and mines to maximize destruction. Ed and the rest would lie in wait to provide cover and shoot down any enemy survivors attempting to escape. Stowalski's second-in-command among the pioneers was an old comrade and close friend of Ed's, an expert in laying mines, an explosives and demolitions specialist. He was SS Oberscharführer Willy Forster. Willy was the son of an East Prussian farmer, a brave and resourceful soldier, a dedicated National Socialist and expert pioneer. He had served alongside Ett in the Brandenburg ZBV 800 and had transferred into the Waffen-SS Oranienburg along with the rest of the unit. Forster was several years older than Ett, but his educational background was not sufficient for him to be promoted to officer rank, and he remained an NCO while Ett became an officer and head of the Kampfergruppe. The operation called for the liquidation of all the enemy staff, and one clear escape route had been left for them, to be drawn into Ett's ambush on a wood-covered hill close by. The charges were set to detonate at 1 a.m, and all seemed to be proceeding well. It was still only midnight as Ett watched his pioneers at work through the night-vision field glasses. Suddenly, there were shots, and soldiers in khaki uniforms were running around the compound area. "Damn! We have been discovered." It was Sergeant Major Kirschner who spoke. He was lying in the bushes alongside Ed. The group on the hill could not believe what was happening. Ed was sure that all the guards had been killed and that the relief was not due to appear on the compound perimeter until 2 a.m. Turning to Kirschner, Ed asked, "Are you sure that the guards you killed were Americans?" Kirschner confirmed that the sentries were in American uniforms, but wore an unfamiliar regimental badge with the word Polski on it. Ett realized the problem at once. These were not Americans, but Free Polish troops, serving alongside the Canadian forces. Ett regarded the Poles as excellent soldiers and extremely dangerous. Kirschner was confused. Ett remembered his questions. "Poles here? We had some encounters with them on the Eastern Front. They were pretty nasty. What they did to German prisoners was beyond our understanding." Ett remembered those actions only too well. But those troops were Red Poles, Polish communist troops serving in the Red Army. Those facing them now were White Poles, Polish troops who had escaped to England in 39-40 and now fought with the Western Allies as Free Poles. Ett was worried. These units were not only good soldiers, but had a reputation for extreme cruelty when dealing with German prisoners, and were regarded as worse than the Red Poles in such matters. The Kampfergruppe had two guides with them, who were local to the district and knew the terrain well. One was with Stowalski's pioneers, and the other was with Ett's group. Ett sent Kirschner to find the guide at once. They returned 2 minutes later, and Ett explained the situation. With only 20 men on the left of him, He could not defeat the superior enemy force in an open fight. He needed to gain an advantage. Ed needed the guide to provide a route to get between the Polish guards unnoticed. The Poles were all concentrated at one point and had obviously not yet discovered the rest of the Kampfergruppe around the compound. If Ed could get down among the Poles, he could launch a surprise attack with portable flamethrowers, which would make up for the lack of numbers. The guide pointed out a dried-up watercourse down below, which was heavily overgrown. It would be difficult to get through, but would serve the purpose. Ed left three men behind to guard the transport and split the rest into groups. Commands were not necessary. The men all knew each other well and set out to infiltrate the Polish perimeter. It was difficult for Ed and his group to make progress along the watercourse unobserved. The undergrowth was thick and tangled, so they were forced to hack their way along using bayonets and combat knives like machetes. As they seemed to be making ground more quickly, the group were halted by loud shouting. Ed peered carefully over the edge of the gully and saw a dreadful sight, a horrible scene which would always return to haunt him. He had witnessed many terrible sights, but this was the worst. SS Oberscharführer Willy Forster had been captured when the Polish guards were alerted, and now they were intent on having some fun with him. Unaware that other German troops were outside the compound perimeter. A group of Poles had stripped Forster naked and tied him to a tree. The shouting had turned to screaming as they gouged out his eyes with a knife. Then they turned to his genitals. At first, Ed could do nothing. His men and their weapons were not yet in place, and there were at least 100 enemy soldiers scattered around the compound area. Ed hurried his men along. The time taken was only minutes, but felt like ages, as Forster continued to scream. He was alive, but in agony. Then the men were in position. Ed yelled to a sharpshooter, "Kill Willy first!" The shot rang out, followed by the roar of the flamethrowers and the firing of automatic weapons. The Poles torturing Willy Forster were transformed into human torches. The SS men avoided shooting them down, letting them burn first before finishing off the twitching, blackened forms with a few well-placed shots. As firing continued along the perimeter, Ed was suddenly joined by Untersturmführer Stawalski and the remaining pioneers who had gone into hiding when the guards had struck, but were drawn out now by the sounds of the massacre around the tree. Stawalski had urgent news. The Kampfergruppe had to break contact with the enemy and evacuate immediately. When the guards had interrupted him and his pioneers, Stawalski had advanced the ignition devices. The demolition charges would go off at any time. Ed led his men back along the dry watercourse at the run. They regained their positions on the wooded hill just in time as the charges detonated. An enormous blast shook the ground like an earthquake. The charges exploded in rapid succession, gutting the Allied installation. The Kampfergruppe did not take the risk of checking for survivors. It was doubtful if anyone within the perimeter could have lived through the explosions. The SS men had cut all the communication lines before laying the charges, but there was a small possibility that the Poles had raised the alarm by radio after discovering the enemy on their base. Ed and his men quickly boarded their transport and drove back along the country roads towards the German lines at rapid speed. On reaching their jumping-off point, they destroyed the vehicles and set out to regain the German lines on foot, returning through the same location they had crossed through earlier. Shouting out the passwords, they regained German-held positions without further difficulty. It was November the 11th, 1944, and the date was significant. The Kampfergruppe had lost four men, plus Willie Forster. Five dead was not many for an action of that kind, but had Ett known that their opponents were Polish troops, he would have taken more men and had a different strategy. The Poles had a habit of inspecting their guards at random and were known for their obsessive security. Ett had encountered the problem in the past. However, the manner of Willie Forster's death had a deeper effect, and from that moment on, Ett Volsink nurtured a hatred of the Poles and the Polish nation. On November the 11th, 1944, SS Oberscharführer Willie Forster died as a prisoner of the White Poles. He was tortured and slowly slaughtered in the most beastly way. I had watched this from a short distance and was unable to interfere. Interference would have meant sacrificing my whole Kampfergruppe to this Polish scum, and in spite of my impotent fury, I was condemned to look on, all the time, shuddering. In wartime, it is the duty of a soldier to kill as many of the enemy as possible, but not in the way that the Poles had killed Willie Forster. Ett Volsink saw the slow death of Willie as a sadistic murder, not the only case of Polish ferocity he had seen, but certainly the worst. The 11th of November is the German War Memorial Day. Each year, the veterans of Germany's wars gather at the military cemeteries to remember their fallen. As Ett Volsink said, when the trumpets start playing the melody, Ich hatte einen Kameraden, I had a comrade. My thoughts, despite the thousands I have killed or seen killed, go out to him. SS Oberscharführer Willie Forster. Ett was wounded for the second time during a preparation mission for the Ardennes Offensive of winter 1944. He received a clean wound through the right hip from a heavy caliber shot. He was fortunate that his comrades saw fit to evacuate him to the German lines, after first securing first aid treatment from a country doctor, who was taken in by the Allied uniforms that Ett and his squad were wearing. A wounded man on a mission behind enemy lines is a burden and a threat to the safe completion of the mission. Dragging the wounded along slows down the withdrawal and distracts the unit when every man needs to be extra alert for the enemy. The usual procedure in the SS Oranienburg and in the Kampfergruppe of the Brandenburg had been to leave the wounded behind to make their own way back if they could, or for them to end their suffering with a poison capsule or a pistol bullet. Despite his wound, Ett was fortunate on this occasion that his comrades were determined to take him with them and refused to leave him behind. During the journey back, Ett and his comrades saw one of the new weapons in action in the sky above their heads, the ram planes, which crashed deliberately into attacking Allied bombers. Ett remembers how he and his comrades cheered on the fanatical Luftwaffe pilots who so desperately tried to halt the enemy bombers. The wound took a month to heal and left him with a permanent but slight limp. The more immediate problem was that he missed service in the Ardennes Offensive completely. Ett spent Christmas 1944 in hospital, being taken care of by German nuns, and remembered the hospital being visited by senior party officials who brought gifts of cigarettes and cognac for the sick and wounded troops. Unfit for combat duty, for several weeks, Ett was moved from hospital to an SS Erholungsheim to recuperate. One of the stranger duties undertaken by Ett Volsink during his period of recuperation was his involvement with the Lebensborn organization. Many women of wealthy German families had become widows by this stage of the war and were often left without children to inherit the family estates. So the SS provided an answer through the Lebensborn organization, which could offer the women a racially acceptable officer to father children without the complications of marriage or commitment on his part. It was not until the late 1980s that Ett Volsink realized his duty had been successful when a young woman his unknown granddaughter contacted him. Once he was passed as fit for service again, Ett was sent into Hungary, where the Soviet forces were advancing. It was during the closing months of the war in the West that Ett Volsink was wounded for the third and final time. In many ways, this was a ridiculous wound, and the circumstances of it continued to cause him some amusement in his later years. His Kampfgruppe was returning from a mission against the American forces, having successfully destroyed a supply and distribution depot, as well as liquidating the best part of the depot staff. The Kampfgruppe numbered about 40 men, travelling in captured enemy vehicles and wearing enemy uniforms. Contact was maintained with German forces by means of shortwave radios in the vehicles. It was during this return journey that the Kampfgruppe received a transmission from the Geheimfeldpolizei, warning them that the German High Command had decided to arrange a shortening of the front in that sector and was withdrawing to a better defensive position. The withdrawal was taking place across the area into which the Kampfgruppe was moving. The journey continued across a military wasteland, devastated by demolitions and mined by the retreating German troops. The Kampfgruppe received orders to maintain radio contact with the GFP, and later, after travelling several miles forward, to make contact via field radio with the regular Wehrmacht units in the area to avoid being fired upon by their own troops. In order to prevent a tragedy, Ett ordered his men to strip off the enemy uniforms and don their German camouflage suits. A short time later, they encountered a Waffen-SS unit, which was acting as a Natschkommando, that is, a rearguard formation, the last to cover territory which is being given up. The SS unit was covering a three-point road crossing, two routes from the south, one of which the Kampfgruppe had used, and one to the north, over which the German evacuation was being carried out. The SS troops had expected still more German troops to be coming up from the south, but time was running very late for this to be likely. The officer in charge, an SS Obersturmführer, decided not to wait any longer, assuming that the remaining units had used a different route. The SS unit began to evacuate the road position, along with Ett's Kampfgruppe, the captured vehicles providing welcome transport. Along with this mixed force would travel the two GFP radio operators who had been directing the Kampfgruppe to safety. Ett stayed behind at the road position, together with the SS Obersturmführer and four NCOs, just in case any stragglers turned up, with the likelihood that they would need help from advancing enemy forces. The Obersturmführer had field radio contact with his regiment and agreed to wait another hour, retaining a few men and a light anti-tank cannon as a precaution. Ett was to travel back in the SS officer's jeep. The tiny group took cover in bushes overlooking the crossroads and sat back to wait. They relaxed and smoked cigarettes, exchanging experiences and generally killing time, when one of the lookouts spotted a single jeep approaching their position along a road to the south. Through their field glasses, they observed four rather optimistic Americans driving carelessly through no man's land and drinking heavily from shared bottles as they went. The four GIs obviously took it for granted that the area had been deserted by German troops and were acting with total disregard to any possible mines or booby traps which the retreating Wehrmacht might have left behind. After a swift consultation, Ett and the SS officers agreed to let the Americans come on and to take them prisoner. It was always possible that they might have some information which would be useful to German headquarters. The ambush group waited until the American jeep arrived at the crossroads and was positioned between the light anti-tank cannon and the group with Ett. Immediately, the SS men came out of hiding and challenged the men in the jeep, calling on them to stop and surrender. Despite being befuddled by alcohol, the Americans realized that their position was hopeless and gave up without a fight, throwing their weapons out of the jeep. As the only English speaker among the SS group, Ett advanced a few yards forwards and ordered the Americans out of their vehicle. The GIs reluctantly obeyed the instruction when suddenly their officer spotted the SS runes on the German soldiers' uniforms. Immediately, and probably out of panic, no doubt fueled by alcohol consumption and atrocity propaganda about SS baby gassers, the American officer produced a tiny pistol and began shooting. The drunken GI was rather unsteady on his feet, and his erratic fire missed the SS men completely, but one round hit Ett in his lower arm. The other Americans, meanwhile, scrambled to retrieve their weapons from the roadside. This was the last mistake that any of them made. In a short burst of accurate fire, the four Americans were mown down. To quote Ett Volsink, "You simply cannot surrender one moment and start your war again a minute later." There was great laughter among the SS men when they searched the dead American officer and discovered the hidden weapon which had wounded Ett. There, in the dead man's hand, was a tiny automatic pistol with mother-of-pearl grips, probably inherited from some great-grandmother, hardly a weapon for the battlefront. It was difficult to believe that he seriously intended to take on a squad of Waffen-SS troops with such a weapon. Equally embarrassing for Ett was the fact that he had been wounded by what was virtually a toy pistol. In the meantime, his embarrassing wound was bleeding quite heavily, so they tied up his arm to staunch the blood flow and bandaged the wound. The SS men stripped the dead GIs of their weapons, documents, and a jeep full of food, drink, and cigarettes, leaving the dead heroes to be buried by their advancing friends. By the time Ett and his SS companions had reached the relative safety of the German front lines, he was more than a little drunk on looted American bourbon. The positions were occupied by a panzer unit, and Ett was taken to the formation's casualty station for treatment. The field surgeon had few problems treating the wound. The small-caliber bullet had passed through Ett's arm just above the wrist, narrowly missing an artery. He was quickly patched up, and with only a light dressing on, was sent back to his unit on light duties. Despite being shot at with much heavier weapons in the coming months, it was to be his last wound in combat. The fighting continued, as increasingly desperate missions were launched on all fronts to halt the enemy advance. Roads and bridges were mined, and installations destroyed. Anti-tank mines were vital weapons in countering the enemy armoured spearheads where no mines were available. Unexploded aerial bombs or artillery shells would be used as a source of high explosives. Ett recalls much digging in the dirt roads of Poland and Silesia as his group planted high explosives and mines to hinder the Soviet mechanised columns. It was during this period that Ett found himself in a small town in eastern Germany. He had just returned from an action against the advancing Red Army and was reporting to a unit of the GFP for fresh orders, the Geheimfeldpolizei. The GFP and the regular military police of the Feldgendarmerie were busy rounding up stragglers from fragmented Wehrmacht and Luftwaffe units which were withdrawing through the town after a heavy Soviet attack. To Ett's surprise, the commander of the GFP was delighted to see him. Not because he had fresh orders for Ett's Kampfergruppe, but because Ett was an SS Hauptsturmführer. It transpired that the small town had been left without a Kommandantur, and only senior NCOs and junior officers were left there to organise and control the sector. Ett was horrified at the suggestion, but his protests were fruitless. He was appointed Abschnittskommandant for the town, and was responsible for all military administration until an officer of higher rank could be located. Years later, Ett reflected on this crazy situation. He was very young, but had been out in enemy territory for weeks, not shaving, no bath and tired, but appearing older. The GFP were good soldiers, but saw only the rank insignia of a Waffen-SS combat officer, and so Ert had to take over as Abschnitt's commandant. Fortunately for him, some hours later, reserve units were passing through the town and he was able to hand over his unwanted position as town commander to a regular army officer of higher rank. Ert and his Kampfergruppe were switched from front to front, finally being dispatched once again to the Balkans to fight Tito and his communist partisan armies. Meanwhile, the Reichsfuhrer SS was actively preparing the Werwolf, the organization which would carry on the NS struggle and preserve National Socialism after the defeat of the Third Reich and the overthrow of Germany by the Allies. Although he did not know it at the time, with his type of military background, his connections with the RSHA, and his proven dedication to the National Socialist cause, Ert Wolfsink was an ideal candidate for inclusion in the Werwolf. Several times during his service with both ZBV 800 Brandenburg and the SS Oranienburg, Ert was sent for communications training at the SS Funk School, the radio operator's school at Dachau. The Brandenburg Central Training Establishment had an arrangement with the Waffen-SS, whereby specialist officers and NCOs from the Kampfergruppen could go to Dachau to train alongside SS communications specialists. The SS radio school was located in the SS military complex, a short distance from the concentration camp of the same name. The SS officers from all the different units at Dachau, the radio school, the Waffen-SS supply depot, the ordnance training workshops, the KZ, concentration camp, all used the same recreational facilities, officers' mess, and other things. So during his training courses at the Dachau complex, Ert Wolfsink was able to meet many of the SS officers guarding the concentration camp. The SS formations guarding the KZ installations were by this time older men from the SS Werfergangstruppen rather than the Totenkopf regiments. Many of the SS troops guarding the KZ at Dachau were ethnic Germans from Romania and Hungary. The majority of the officers Ert met in the SS officers' mess at Dachau had been invalidated out of frontline service after being wounded in action. Ert became quite good friends with some of these officers and was taken on a tour of the concentration camp by them. He recalled that conditions there were harsh, but not as severe as the post-war camps and prisons he was detained in after 1945. The training visits to the SS Funk School were often very short, varying from a few days to a couple of weeks, just long enough to master the particular piece of specialist equipment which was the subject of the course. Often, examples of captured enemy communications equipment were available for study and evaluation. Ert found that the instructors at Dachau were friendly and easier to get along with than the more rigid instructors from the Wehrmacht training schools. The majority of the SS instructors were combat signalers on temporary assignment from the frontline units and understood the lifestyle of soldiers from the Brandenburg and Oranienburg units. On one of his visits to the radio school at Dachau, Ert met one of his Waffen-SS comrades who was living on the inside of the Dachau KZ as an inmate. It transpired that this comrade was a particularly headstrong character who had volunteered for service in the Waffen-SS and was determined to serve in SS Division Viking. However, when he had completed his training, he was given marching orders to join a different SS division. Therefore, without waiting or seeking any kind of change of orders or asking permission, he set out alone to join the Viking division. Needless to say, the stubborn SS recruit was picked up by the military police and sent to the SS prison section at Dachau. After a short stay in the punishment section, he was able to convince the Dachau authorities that he should serve in the SS Viking, and in due course he was sent to join the staff company of SS Division Viking, where he was to serve happily for the rest of the war. In post-war years, he would recall with Et his time in Dachau, where he was on the inside and Et on the outside. And tomorrow, we'll find out what happens at the end of the war.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.